This is the Monday Morning Quarterback Podcast with Andy Benoit and your host, John Engel.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the MMQB Podcast with Andy Benoit. I'm John Engel at Engel's Angle on Twitter. You can follow Andy at Andy_Benoit. Remember to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Just search MMQB on iTunes. And Andy, we'll start off the only way that we could with the Chicago Bears and the benching of Jay Cutler electing to go with Jimmy Clausen this week.
Yeah, who would have thought that we're heading into week 16 and there are 9 playoff spots open and we decide we're going to start with Bears and Lions. I mean, Lions, I guess, could be in one of those playoff spots, but I was shocked at hearing this. Not so much because Cutler hasn't, you know, I think Cutler, it's warranted. I understand the logic. We'll get into that in a second, but I've never seen a big-time quarterback like this, a guy that, and he's big-time by his salary and the minds of the people that make these decisions often or influence them, front office guys, and I don't know if that's the case here or not, but front office guys, he's a big-time quarterback because they're cutting his checks. I've never seen one get benched under these circumstances. I'm sure they have. I just can't remember the last one.
And next year he has a guaranteed $15.5 million on the books for the Bears. So if the idea is possibly to trade him, is that the right move for the Bears?
I don't know if the idea is to trade him, though. I mean, maybe. He's the only big-time quarterback I've ever seen get traded, too, because he got traded to Chicago from Denver. I wonder what Trestman's thinking here. I mean, I understand it. I just wonder what his logic was, and my only guess at it would be that he's trying to win a football game. And we've talked about with the Rams and with Washington about you can't put when these guys are struggling as bad as they are, you can't put them on the field and then keep the locker room. And I think Trestman bumps into a little bit of that. And my sense also with that Aaron Cromer stuff from last week where, you know, Cutler's not making the proper checks at the line of scrimmage. My sense is that's a much bigger issue than people realize and that the Bears have let on, that Cutler must really be screwing some of that stuff up.
Do you agree with Cromer's statements then about Cutler last week?
I can't speak to that because I don't know. You can watch the film, but you don't know what the calls are. So you don't know what the checks and, you know, rules about that. There's so many different rules based on formation, situation, defensive look. It's almost you'd have to play in the league a long time to have a shot at understanding or guessing what those teams' rules are from the outside. So I can't speak to that. But I do know Cromer. You know, I've gotten to know him a little bit. And he's very honest, very intelligent, a very nice guy. I was surprised that he'd be the source. And my guess is that he was just having a conversation with the guy. He wasn't anything malicious about it. And also, if he speaks, I listen to him.
You know, when you're saying that you don't see Jay Cutler being traded necessarily and that this isn't a sign of that, you'd almost think that benching him would just be to keep him healthy then and not risk losing him when he has so much guaranteed money coming.
I don't think so. I mean, because the last time we saw that was Robert Griffin had that case under Mike Shanahan, and I thought that Shanahan used that as an excuse to protect Griffin and avoid the kind of stuff that Jay Gruden's experiencing with Griffin, which is public backlash or surprise about Griffin being benched. Shanahan benched Griffin because Griffin was playing awful that year, and he was worried about Griffin being able to protect himself. Cutler, he's taking a lot of hits throughout his career, but he has a decent offensive line now, and he's not getting banged around. So he knows how to protect himself. He's not very good at it, but at least he knows how. I think they're just looking to find a better quarterback, and maybe it's an attitude thing a little bit that they feel like they have to get through to Cutler in this way, but that coaching staff likes him. He's gotten along well with Trestman, gotten along well with Cromer before all this. So I don't know what's behind it, but I understand the logic of it because he's turning the ball over. He's taking hits he doesn't need to be taking. And he's also missing some checks at the line of scrimmage.
Clausen will now be making his first start since 2010, that rookie year with Carolina. What is he going to run into against this Detroit Lions defense?
Well, it's a fast front seven, as we know. And it's a back four that has still played pretty well in coverage. And we were wondering if that would hold up throughout the season with Darius Slay at cornerback. He had an excellent first half of the season. He's had a very good second half. He's not quite where he was in the first half, but overall he's been good. Rasheen Mathis has been an excellent corner for what they need out of him. And Glover Quinn's coming off one of those big-time Player of the Week awards, I believe.
That's right, yeah. And the Lions have to keep winning if they plan to get into the playoffs. These next two games are very important, and then that Week 17 game against Green Bay.
It is, although can they get away with – this is a mathematical question. Is this a must-win for them, or can – I mean, it's obviously important, a must-win, but can they get away with losing and still be – I guess they wouldn't be in control of their own destiny then.
Yeah, if they beat Green Bay in Week 17, they're in.
No matter what?
No matter what.
Okay, so this really isn't a huge game for Detroit.
I guess not necessarily.
I mean, it's big because you want to have wild card. You want to be up for the wild card in case you don't beat Green Bay. But remember a few years ago when Seattle had a must win in Week 17, Week 17 was a must win. Week 16 was an irrelevant game. They played the Rams. That's the thing you get with these divisional games at the end. The league tried to get rid of the irrelevant games late in the season. All they did was actually just push a bunch of them into Week 16 instead of 17. This isn't irrelevant, but it's not as relevant as it seems.
Last week we mentioned that Mark Trestman's job being secure is the right path for the Bears. With all this shakeup in the last week, do you still feel that way?
I wonder if he still feels that way. I mean, does he make this decision about Cutler if his job security is where it is? I don't like to guess at these things. I can't tell you that. I think Trestman deserves to be back. I would keep him around. But, you know, I've also thought, I'm not sure he's the best fit for the Bears' personality. Mark Trestman it's not easy going, but he's big and everyone is responsible for themselves. He treats people like grown-ups, and he's not a big rah, rah, rah type of guy. He's a intelligent, well-spoken. He'd rather be very thoughtful than very inspirational. And so if you have that kind of guy, I think you need a leader in the locker room, and the Bears are really deprived of that. Cutler's not that kind of leader. He's not, you know, he's just not. So you almost need a Tom Brady type or a Peyton Manning type presence. So I'm not sure Trestman fits the Bears as well, but conceptually, as a head coach, I'd take him to head coach my football team.
AFC matchup on Monday night, Broncos on the road against the Bengals. What do you expect the Bengals to come at Peyton Manning with on defense? Do you try to blitz Manning, or are you going to sit back in coverage? No one seems to have really figured out what the formula for success is.
Well, San Diego played coverage last week, and it didn't work great for them. Some teams, the idea has always been you don't blitz Manning, but we've also talked about you have to change up your coverages and disguise it. Now, a lot of disguises, in fact, some of Cincy's best disguises do come out of their blitz packages, but they have not been blitzing a whole lot themselves either lately. And I would expect that to remain the case. I think you stick with two high safety concepts, but you still do some disguises. And so it's a matter of now, how are you getting into those disguises without having it be a blitz thing? If they do want to send pressure, they could still do pressure concepts without blitzing. They're very good at zone blitzes where they drop a defensive lineman or two into coverage. When you do that, you send one or two extra pass rushers, but you're not actually blitzing. It's four guys rushing, just a different four than usual. That's called a zone exchange. They might want to consider something like that, because if you do a zone concept and you drop a defensive lineman, that's a great way to take away shallow crossing routes, and shallow crossing routes are where Denver really beats you.
Is that what the Bengals did against the Browns in that shutout win?
The Bengals lined up and played against a quarterback that wasn't quite ready to be on an NFL field.
Yeah,
we can
Johnny
talk
Manziel
about him in the next. We can talk about him later in the show, but they did nothing. They looked like they knew exactly what play was coming with the Browns, and that's a statement I almost never make because I know teams don't know what's coming. But they outclassed the Browns in every fashion last week.
On offense for Cincinnati, Jeremy Hill is coming off an AFC Offensive Player of the Week award.
Are we really going to start touting these players? I was kind of tongue in cheek when I touted Glover Quinn for Player of the Week.
Well, no, it should be noted. 148 yards on the ground.
Yeah, but now we got to note it every week. There's eight of these awards, aren't there? There's six. AFC offense, defense, special team. I don't want to get into noting these
awards.
But
when the award is given to a running back that wasn't previously the featured running back, like Giovanni Bernard was, do you see the Bengals going in a direction that's more focused on Jeremy Hill?
I do, and he played, I think it was 46 snaps last week, and he had 25 carries on 46 snaps. So when he's in the game, he's someone, you know, he's in on first and second down, and that's who they're feeding and working off of. This is what they want. They drafted Giovanni Bernard to be what he is now, which is a complimentary back. And it was behind Ben Jarvis Green Ellis, who I think they knew they had to replace eventually. And Jeremy Hill's a much better Ben Jarvis Green Ellis. He gets skinny through cracks when he needs to. He's a downhill type runner, but he has a hint of elusiveness. He fits their system extremely well, and it's a team that does a lot of stuff with man-blocking concepts. And Jeremy Hill, I think, is a good guy to have running behind man blockers, which man blocking's stuff like power and counter, where you often where you see a pull blocker. Anytime a lineman goes on the move separate from the rest of the line, he pulls or something. That's a man blocking concept.
Seems like the Bengals are happy with Jeremy Hill, and that's the direction they are going. The Dallas Cowboys are still a little up in the air with their running back situation. DeMarco Murray underwent surgery. He's back practicing. This is probably a must-win for the Cowboys, too. A big win in the Jason Garrett era over the Eagles. What do you expect from the Cowboys against the Colts this week?
Well, let's assume Murray's out, just for the sake of conversation, because I think he will be out. But also, that's the question. I mean, if it's a must-win, their best player is banged up, so the question is how much can they do without him? I think they'll be just fine without DeMarco Murray. They won't be as good in the ground game, but you know how I feel about Dallas's running game, John. It's offensive line driven primarily. It's, by the way, an offensive line that two of the last three outings, or whatever the number of outings are over the course of the Philly games, both times they played Philadelphia, got defeated in the trenches. They did not dominate the Eagles. In fact, Philly dominated them again last week. Now, I just bring that up as something to keep in mind moving forward as we get near the playoffs here. I don't think it'll be the case with Indianapolis this week. The Colts have – I like the Colts' defensive line, especially with Arthur Jones back healthy, and Ricky Jean-Francois made some plays last week. He flashed a bit. Josh Chapman did pretty well at times against zone blocking in the Houston game. They've got some pieces there, but they're not a dominant defensive line like Philadelphia has. So I think Dallas can run effectively, and it's going to be whoever it is running, it's going to be based on the offensive lineman's movement.
The attention goes to DeMarco Murray and that Cowboys offense, but defensively, that's been the unknown variable all season for Dallas. How differently will they approach Pep Hamilton and Andrew Luck in this Colts offense that's coming, which is different than Philly?
It is different than Philly, and I am real curious to see the answer to your question, because Philadelphia almost forces you to play man-to-man coverage because of the fast tempo. Indianapolis is not that kind of offense. They'll play up tempo, but you know, they're not the Philadelphia Eagles. They don't do it every snap. And so will Dallas play cover three, which they've played as their staple most of the season? They're not a cover two defense, as we've talked about. Cover three is it's a zone concept, only with one high safety instead of two. And it has a lot of different principles than cover two. And what it does have is matchup principles, meaning you can play man-to-man on the outside and zone in the middle of it. And maybe they'll do some form of that, because their cornerbacks have been okay in man-to-man lately. They've actually improved a lot there. But if you just line up and play straight cover three against the Colts, you're going to get beat, because Indy is, as I wrote about this week, I think they're one of the best cover three beating offenses in football just by design. Andrew Luck reads the field so well that he sees anytime he's got the right route combination, he's going to recognize it. And so you've got so in that case, what do you do to disturb route combinations? Well, if you just line up and play zone, he'll recognize what you're doing. If you line up and play man-to-man, at least you can alter the timing of some of those routes and force the Colts to break down that way. And I think that's what they have to do, because I'm not 100% sold on Dallas's pass rush yet.
This has been one of the more inconsistent stretches for Andrew Luck. What do you read into maybe some of the recent struggles there by your main man?
Really?
No, always.
Yeah, well, I'll take him as my main man, because I thought he played fine against Houston. The scoreboard maybe didn't indicate that so much, but the Texans had some very good man-to-man coverage of their own on the outside. The Colts misconnected on some back shoulder throws, and I don't know if that's on Luck or if it's on the receiver. Where Andrew Luck has to continue to be careful is with turnovers, but that gets inflated as well. You know, some of them have come off pressure, which is not always the quarterback's fault. And like last week, where he threw that pick six to Kendrick Lewis, that was on Kobe Fleener. And Kobe Fleener's a guy you go to if you want to have turnovers happen, it seems like. I mean, Fleener's not a reliable tight end. So Luck, I'm fine with Luck. He doesn't have all the pieces around him all the time yet.
A great matchup out of the NFC West this week. Seahawks, Cardinals. These two teams met a month ago, and the Seahawks held the Cardinals to 204 yards and 3 points. Since then, Drew Stanton's down, Andre Ellington's down, and Seattle's D is just getting better and faster. We have an interview with Larry Foote coming up from the Cardinals, so we'll get to that in a minute. What do you think might be different about this game? Are we expecting another Sunday night blowout?
I don't see how – Greg Bedard wrote how the Cardinals can pull this one off. I don't see how that happens. I mean, let's not forget how, and I hate to do this, but let's not forget how utterly inept Ryan Lindley looked when he played against I think it was the Jets a few years ago. I remember it was the only film, it was the Jets, because I remember it was the only film I ever turned off just for sheer incompetence at quarterback. And there was no point in watching it because you couldn't tell how the plays were unfolding because Lindley was just so out in left field. You know, he's older now, he's more mature, I don't know, but he hasn't played. So how much do we really bet on any of that changing?
Probably not.
I mean, and then you take the other factor with Ellington being out. That hasn't gotten enough attention because not only and he hasn't had as big a year as a lot of us, mainly me, thought he would have, but he's still a dynamic runner, and so you lose that in the running game. They've done a good job of compensating in their running game since he's been out, with Williams at that tailback and Stephon Taylor, and the offensive line's played well. But what Ellington gave them that no one else can is the dimension in the passing game. He split out wide. He was always a receiving threat out of the backfield. He was very big in some of their trips concepts that they do, and he was a mismatch maker, and Bruce Arians is excellent with those type of players. So now they lost that dimension, so it's a more limited passing attack schematically, and that's the last thing you want when you're plugging in, what is this now, their third, fourth quarterback, something like that?
The Seahawks already have that top-ranked defense, and we know they concede even against great quarterbacks. But when you bring in a guy like Lindley, does that allow you to take more risks as a defense? Or do you see them bringing more pressure and just forcing Lindley to beat them?
Well, I don't think Seattle needs to play that way. The worst quarterback you face, I believe the more you can play to your own style of preference. And for Seattle, that style of preference is just to line up and play. Now, they had success last week. In fact, I think five of their six sacks on Kaepernick last week came off of a blitz. That's highly uncommon for Seattle, though, and they didn't blitz a whole lot in that game still. They might do that. They'll definitely do some of that against Lindley, but they're not going to change their foundation. Why would they? I mean, just they killed this team last time playing their straight-up style. Just do that again.
You have to go up against two really good wide receivers in Larry Fitzgerald, Michael Floyd. We both thought Michael Floyd would emerge as maybe the featured wide receiver this season for Arizona. It hasn't really shaken out that way, though. Larry Fitzgerald's the leading receiver, has the most receptions. Why has that happened? Bruce Arians hasn't gone the direction of Michael Floyd the way we talked about, and it's still Larry Fitzgerald's team.
Well, it's not Bruce Arians not going in that direction. It's just the way the offense has shaken out more. And I thought Floyd emerged last year. I mean, he was a 1,000-yard receiver. He led that team, and it was a quality offense that he was leading in the passing game. He's been a little quieter this year, and Arizona's offense, what was it? Aaron said I can't remember. It was clever, though. It was like the go-to guy is the open guy or something catchy phrase. But that's how they're designed. It truly is a progression read type of offense. So they're not designing plays to get one guy open. They're designing concepts. And, in fact, they do a great job balancing the field with certain route combinations on one side and, contrasting route combinations on the other side in order to get the best concept available. It's a lot of read and react type of stuff, which, by the way, is another reason you question whether Lindley's going to succeed here.
On the other side of the ball, like you said, Greg Bedard pointed out some ways that Arizona could win this game and what they needed to do to win this game, and a lot of it had to do with defense and containing Russell Wilson. This defense coming in, a lot of their pressure concepts involve Larry Foote, who we'll get to his interview in just a minute. Do you see anything changing in the pressure concepts that they brought from just a month ago for Arizona?
I think it depends how the game flows, because Todd Bowles, he does those he does those in crucial situations when it's games on the line.
Risky.
When it's close. Yeah. And to him, I think he would tell you he feels it's risky not to. And I admire that. You don't see coaches do that very often. It's the anti-prevent defense. I think he's going to wait a little bit to see how the game unfolds, because as we've talked about, you have to do things a little different against Russell Wilson because he does so much out of structure. And so what will those different tactics be? I mean, that's Todd Bowles' job to figure out. I don't have an answer for him. We always talk about spying Wilson. They could do that. They have the athletes for it. They play a lot of dime defense, which means that they have six DBs on the field, and so they're a faster defense than most teams. That dime defense is the one that had trouble with the read option, at least on one play. It was Deion Buchanan had a missed assignment. Wilson beat him for 40 yards, Other than that, they actually didn't have as much trouble as it seems. But you can't have those 40-yard gains because that's how Seattle gets you. They'll swing the game with that.
Who better to explain these concepts that Bowles uses than Larry Foote? And we'll get into an interview right now. Larry Foote with Andy Benoit.
Speaking with Cardinals inside linebacker Larry Foote. And Larry, I'll say the same thing to you now that I said when we spoke a few weeks ago, which is that I thought you were supposed to be an old man just coming off a season-long injury. What's gotten into you this year?
Man, I'm on a good team, and it's contagious. When you're playing around good players, that no matter how old you are, you got to play at a high level, keep up with these guys. And man, it's fun, man. We're 11-3. We're in a very competitive division. These guys are excited. They're hungry. So it's mind over age right now.
Well, last time you and I spoke, I was working on a piece about double-A gap pressure. And just quickly for our listeners who don't know, double-A gap pressure, it's a growing defensive concept. It's where you get two players, usually inside linebackers, in your case in Arizona, often you and a safety, walking up into the A gaps, the gaps between the centers and the guards. And there are a litany of advantages this creates for a defense. And, Larry, you come from Pittsburgh, so you know all about this tactic, and you do it a ton in Arizona. So I'll let you do the talking. Tell our listeners, what are some of your favorite advantages from double A-gap pressure concepts?
Well, a lot of times when you see the double A-gap pressure, it might be zero or some type of fire zone blitz. So when you line up in there, the quarterback has to start thinking. He has to start communicating with his wide receiver just in case we come. He might have to throw it hot. And as long as you sell it, you got to make sure when you're in your stands or whoever I'm in A-gap with, you got to really be trying to sell to the quarterback that you're coming. And if you're not coming, he might check into a throw. He might check into the flats. We might have somebody there. Or sometimes we're coming. But the way our blitz is going, sometimes we're coming, sometimes we're not. So it becomes a chess match with the quarterback.
And for the guys up front, the Calais Campbells, the Frosty Ruckers, I'm sure those guys like you because even when you're not coming, the interior offensive linemen have to react to you and act as if you are coming because they can't just run the risk of giving you a free pass.
Absolutely. So our D-line, they can get a jump on the offensive linemen and knowing that they're not going to get double teamed right away.
So in Pittsburgh and their inside blitzes and a lot of those fire X stuff, you were often the setup man for Lawrence Timmons, eating up the first block and clearing the path for him to come through. It seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, it seems like in Arizona you've gotten to be a little bit more of a pass rusher in these concepts. Is that true? And if it is, what are the differences? How much do you like the differences in approach?
Well, when you're doing the cross, everybody always going to be the second guy. I mean, for years when I was the second guy with Ferrier. But when he retired, I became the first guy. Timmons got to go second. But in this scheme, is basically off with a running back at different blitzes. So a lot of times it might be Buchanan going before me. But sometimes I go first. It's just all about how the offense lines up.
Well, that's interesting. That's something that people on the outside probably don't think about is you don't just call a play and say, this guy gets the blitz now. You call a concept and then line up and then execute the concept based on how the offense is aligned.
Right, and you're hoping that it lines up to your favor that you get to go second. So you can get the sack and get your name in the paper while the other guy do all the dirty work.
You mentioned Deion Buchanan and Todd Bowles. He's done a lot of triple blitz concepts. So Buchanan and even Rashad Johnson's gotten to rush at times. But Buchanan's a guy I want to talk about. He's become an enormous part of your dime package. Would you talk about his progress and what you've taught him and what kind of a player he is to you guys?
He's grown. I mean, he basically been playing safety and linebacker for us all year. And we're throwing a lot on his plate because, you know, nowadays teams want to pass the ball. You don't really see too much smash-mouth football nowadays in the NFL. And especially when you're stopping the run, teams just say, you know, there's no use for us hitting our head against a brick wall. So a lot of teams are just lining up passing and trying. When they do run, it's out of a spread formation. So he's been doing excellent for us. He's been doing a lot of stuff when Washington, he got suspended. So he's kind of filling those roles. Third down, covering the tight end, the backs out the backfield, and he also blitzing and stopping the run for us also.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see what becomes of your sub packages when Darrell Washington comes back if he's on the team next year, because that's another excellent nickel player. Yeah, I guess you haven't played with him, have you, because this is your first year in Arizona.
Right. Now, I was only played with him for 1 week, and that was only in mini camp.
Okay. You'd mentioned the spread concept. I'm glad you said that, because my next question is going to be, with a team like Arizona that plays as much dime as you guys play, it's inevitable that at some point in the game, and probably multiple points in the game, you're going to have to stop the run out of dime, and it might be a run from a spread concept, but either way, you're playing the run. How different is your approach as a run defender out of a dime package versus out of a base personnel, just speaking for you personally?
Well, it goes back to Buchanan. It's a testament to the type of athlete that he is. You don't see that many safeties that can come into the box and that can hold his own. A lot of times when you go dime, a lot of teams will check to the run on you, and they'll pretty much be, you know, they'll outman you, out physical you, because you got a DB in there opposed to a linebacker. So he's holding his own, and as long as that happens, he can stay on the field. We can stay in the dime, and he protects us against the run. As far as me, I just got to – you got to know where your help at always. You know, Bowles does a great job with an extra guy in the box just in case they run the ball. So just from a mental standpoint, what I've been trying to teach Buchanan, to know where our help at, what we got to do with the ball, and how we attack them.
My last question for you, last time against Seattle, you guys had some successful plays against Russell Wilson in the read options, but you also had some cases of missed assignments, and you paid for those. The 40-yard run is one that really comes to mind. So how much work have you guys put in to be ready for the read option this time? And without giving away anything of your game plan, can you tell us and tell our listeners how many different options you have for defensive tactics in defending the read option?
Well, we got a good scheme for it. We did a great job on Marshawn. I think Russell Wilson got out once on us on the 40-yard run. And, I mean, but that's how they win. You know, they kind of got that, especially with Wilson, kind of like Barry Sanders in a sense. You know, a couple sacks, he'll give up a couple sacks, then he'll bust a long run on you. Mm-hmm. So we watched the film. We got to be perfect. We got to be able to get that guy. We did a good job on him, but we got to do more in order to beat those guys. And the plays he made, he just made guys miss. So if we get him down on the ground, we can't blow no assignment, we should be all right. And, you know, when you're going against a tough defense, just like the last few weeks, we got to outplay their defense, and we got to help our offense with as far as getting turnovers and giving them the ball on the short field.
Thanks once again to Larry Foote. That's a great interview, great football talk. The Chiefs and the Steelers. The Chiefs have to win their final two games to grab a wild card spot. And Alex Smith is coming off his most prolific game of the season, which came against the Raiders' defense. How do the Steelers differ from the Raiders, who the Chiefs just saw?
You know, obviously, I think they have better players in Oakland, although I'm higher on Oakland's defense than a lot of people.
You've been pretty big on them all season.
Well, for being what they are, for being a, what, 2-, what are they now, down to 2-12, I guess, at this point.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I'm concerned a little bit about Pittsburgh's defense because that pass rush continues to be somewhat inconsistent. And they've gotten to where they're pretty reliant on their secondary to make plays, and that's a secondary that has not stepped up and done so. The Atlanta game, and it's misleading. You know, I know Willie Gay had that pick six in the Atlanta game. That was a huge play in the game. Harry Douglas should get an assist on it for stopping his slant route, by the way, on it. But Willie Gay is a guy that people throw at. That's part of the reason he has to pick sixes, and he plays with a lot of cushion. Ike Taylor has struggled when he's been healthy and in there lately, as of late. Blake, the young guy, I would be comfortable throwing at Blake by design. Now, the difference, though, is I don't think maybe it doesn't show up as much this week because Kansas City doesn't have much in the wide receiver department. They don't really design plays. They don't design multiple progression reads for wide receivers. They design stuff more in between the numbers. Travis Kelce is a big factor. So it's going to be on the Steelers' back seven players, but more towards the inside. And that's going to be Mike Mitchell and Troy Polamalu. And those are guys you can fool with play designs. And they'll fool you back at times, at least Polamalu will. But Andy Reid's, as we, you know, he's a good play designer. He can do stuff against them. I would expect them to attack Mike Mitchell.
And the Steelers allowed over 400 yards of total offense in both of those wins, too, which is kind of odd.
Yeah, it was offensive-driven wins for Pittsburgh. Their offense has played well lately, and especially, you know, Ben Roethlisberger throwing at the deep intermediate levels he's really good at that, and he was quite effective against Atlanta with that. And it was play action on early downs that got him, because Atlanta sold out against the run game, so they kept Le'Veon Bell in check, but they paid a price for it.
Can you explain how the Steelers utilize their great wide receivers? Antonio Brown, Martavis Bryant is coming out as being a good option for Ben Roethlisberger as well. A lot of stacked sets, it seems, off those play action plays.
Stacked sets are something they do. They give guys a clean release when they do that, and those are not the biggest. Well, Bryant's pretty big, but like Brown's not the biggest guy. So giving him a clean release is lethal, because he's so quick, and he gets off the line untouched, he's going to beat you. So they do a good job with that in design. They put defenses in a bind. It doesn't look like it, because the routes are often so spread out in Pittsburgh. They use a wide range of the field, and that might be just because of the way Roethlisberger plays. But they put defenses in a bind a lot more than you know. They're a tough team to play zone coverage against. And Kansas City, fortunately for them, is a man coverage team, more man coverage in zone. But then that gets back into those stack releases you talked about and some of that other stuff. Wide receiver screens, the Chiefs have been, I think, pretty good at defending those this year, but they're going to be tested in that department. And then who's going to – the other question you always have to ask with Pittsburgh's passing game is who's going to be accountable for Le'Veon Bell, because he can line up anywhere and he's very dangerous. He's not just a decoy lining up anywhere.
You know, we talk a lot about Alex Smith and the Chiefs and that offense. We don't talk a lot about Jamaal Charles and the talent that he is in the backfield. How has he looked on film this season?
He's looked like Jamaal Charles. He's looked like the guy he was. I would say he's a top five running back. I'd say he's still in that LeSean McCoy class for lateral ability. I thought Niall Davis would be a little bit bigger of a contributor for him this year, and there'd be a little more of a 1-2 punch, but they've been fine with Charles being the primary guy. They still need to get the ball in his hands a little bit more, though. I think Andy Reid would tell you that. There's been three or four times this year where there's been a headline, Andy Reid regrets not feeding the ball to Jamaal Charles more.
Well, last three games, less than 12 rushing attempts for Charles.
Yeah, and that's what I'm talking about. And he's a guy you want to get on the perimeter. He ought to be getting at least seven outside runs alone, toss sweeps, those kind of things.
And he can be utilized in a lot of the same ways that Le'Veon Bell is utilized.
Yeah, you're right. That's a great point. He's a good wide receiver. You split him out wide and he can win. Now, they got DeAnthony Thomas this year, and I think that kind of changed things. I think that took away from some of what they did with Charles, using him on the motion and split out wide and all that stuff.
The Baltimore team that Pittsburgh is fighting for a playoff positioning in that division is at Houston this week, where injuries have now claimed the seasons of quarterbacks Ryan Mallett, Ryan Fitzpatrick, Tom Savage is hurt. The Texans now have to look to either Thaddeus Lewis or Case Keenum as an option against a Baltimore defense that's been great at getting pressure on the quarterback.
Yeah, bet the Ravens in this one.
I mean, take the spread.
Yeah, take the spread. And I don't know what would you think the over-under on Arian Foster's rushing yard. The attempts will be up there. He'll have 25 to 30.
At least.
What's the over-under on his yards? Because he's going to be facing an eight. He has to be facing an eight-man box. You've got to make the quarterback beat you in this game. And not only is it an eight-man box, it's a very fast and physical eight-man box. And the other thing to keep in mind, Houston, I guess, I was going to say Houston's more about spreading the field or zone blocking, stretching the field in the run game. That's probably more of Baltimore now, actually, because they got Houston's old coach. But what I'm getting at is Terrell Suggs is extremely difficult to run some zone plays and bootlegs against because he's so good on the edges. Dumerville, too, to a lesser extent. So not only are you feeding Foster, but I think you're having to feed him between the tackles, because I'm not sure you can consistently run outside against Baltimore.
Baltimore coming off an 8-sack performance against Bortles and the Jaguars last week. Has this pass rush come alive lately, or has this been consistent all year?
I don't know what the numbers have been all year. I mean, they certainly don't average 8 sacks a game, obviously.
No.
But I like this pass rush. Suggs has lost 0% of his ability. Doomerville's, if anything, better than he was 2 or 3 years ago. Chris Canty, when he's back, he's not a pass rusher type, but he's a guy that's very good against the pass because of his length. He'll command some double teams, and he disrupts passing lanes by putting his hands up. Pernell McPhee's an excellent pass rusher. Even Courtney Upshaw can rush a little bit. They don't use him that way, which tells you how talented the pass rush is, that they wouldn't use their high second-round draft pick, who's not bad at turning the corner. They don't even use him as a pass rusher most of the time.
Not a lot of turnovers for that defense, though.
Is that true? What are their numbers?
They had one last week. They didn't have one against Miami. Had two against the Chargers. One against the Saints.
Yeah, they're not controlling the game with turnovers. Turnovers are, you know, they're such a fickle thing at times. They're real, absolutely real. I mean, you want to force them, you want to prevent them if you're on offense, but they can be circumstantial as well. I mean, I think just lining up, I'm a big fan of defenses first and foremost being able to stop you. And I don't know what Baltimore's, since we're on a stat line here, what's Baltimore's defense rank in yards a game and all that stuff?
It looks like they're 13th in yards allowed, 6th in points, though.
Okay, 6th. And the points, to me, that's an accurate reflection. I would say they're, just watching the film, to me, they've been a top 7 or 8 defense easily all year and maybe even top 5.
What about that pass defense? Coming off the bye, they struggled, allowed over 500 total yards of offense to the Saints through the air. And starting to pick up, though, 248 last week against the Jags.
Well, but I mean, the second part of that sentence is important
too. They all count, Andy.
That means you can't go in assuming they'll just beat a team. But Jacksonville doesn't have a dynamic passing attack. It's worth bringing up though, because I said you want to crowd the box if you're Baltimore and force whoever's at quarterback for Houston to beat you. You do want to also keep in mind that Baltimore is thin in the secondary, so this will be telling actually how the Ravens choose to play this defensively. Typically, you would crowd the box here, but because of their issues at cornerback and to a lesser degree, but also at safety, do we see them get conservative and still play two safeties back more than they typically would have? I'm very curious to see how they do it, because we'll learn a lot about how much they're truly worried about their secondary.
Green Bay Packers are coming off a 21-13 loss to the Bills there in Orchard Park. You know, the Packers, it seems to blow your mind that this could even happen, but getting a loss off one of the best defenses in the league in the Bills can't be too surprising.
Well, it's still surprising. I mean, I think the question everyone always wants to know, is there a blueprint now? Whenever a top team loses, they set the blueprint. There wasn't a blueprint set in that Buffalo game. That game was 50% bad Packers, 50% good Bills. And that was what the outcome was driven. And it was decided on the side of the ball. Green Bay had, when Green Bay was on offense, Buffalo was on defense. Aaron Rodgers had the worst game he's played in a long time. He missed a lot of throws. He just wasn't accurate in that game. Are we really going to go on each week betting that Aaron Rodgers won't be accurate?
Probably not.
And so it's these guys are tough to line up and play against, because they got receivers at 4 or 5 different spots that can beat you. And what they did against Buffalo late in the game that I want to see if they'll do again against Tampa Bay, or really any team, because we've seen them do it. And they've done it against Buffalo's a man-to-man team, and New England was a man-to-man team, the other team they did this against, and that is put Randall Cobb in the backfield. They've done it against the man-to-man teams to draw mismatches against linebackers. I wonder if they would be willing to do it against a zone team to still stress linebackers that way. My guess is they probably wouldn't, but I'd like to see, if anyone could come up with something. Mike McCarthy understands offense a lot better than I do. I'd love to see if they did have an idea for that, because I think Cobb has to be moved around a lot. I think he's the key to that offense being top-notch.
Do you think Aaron Rodgers' experience against Lovie Smith in those NFC North battles has anything to do with this game? Do you think it gives him an advantage, or Lovie an advantage for that matter?
Lovie, no, because with Rodgers, I think you know what you're getting, and when you're talking about a great player, it's hard to do. And the other thing is, that's not a very schematically driven defense. So there's nothing to figure out by Rodgers. He's seen cover 2 and cover 3 his entire life, and that's what Lovie Smith's going to throw at him.
Couldn't stop Derek Anderson. He's their worst nightmare this season, man. 0-2.
With Tampa Bay, well, there's a lot of quarterbacks they haven't stopped this year. Remember Joe Flacco and the Ravens lining up against them. In fact, I guarantee you Green Bay will do this, because they're a plus split receiving team as well, meaning their receivers line up outside the numbers and spread the field. Flacco and the Ravens killed Tampa Bay with that, because when you line up outside those numbers, you spread the zones out and you force defenders who are typically zone players to become one-on-one players, because their help defenders are now too far away from them because the field's been spread. And when you're also playing zone, you're in a different technique than man-to-man. You're in a more vulnerable technique, because typically you're playing to your help. Well, if everything's spread out and the help's not there, now you're in a vulnerable technique, and you probably aren't very good at playing man coverage to begin with. So we're going to see Green Bay spread out. In fact, they're not going to put Cobb in the backfield because he'll be in the slot to exacerbate the spread effect on the defense. And it's not going to work out for Tampa Bay. And there's nothing that Lovie Smith can really do about it unless he wants to change his scheme all of a sudden.
Do you think Rodgers' Week 15 performance changes how people start looking at the MVP race? I think we both had Rodgers pretty far and away above everyone else. Does this bring him back down to earth a little bit?
I doubt it, because if they finish strong, and especially if they beat Detroit, and that'll probably be – that's either going to be a 4:30 game on Fox or the Sunday night game. That's going to be a very watched game. If he plays well in that, that's all people will remember. There's been a lot – go back. It's actually fun, and we won't do it now, but if you ever have time at work or something, go back and Google some of these upsets late in the year, because there's been – every year there's a team that gets upset, that, you know, like a number one seed that just loses late in the season. It happens once in a while. The other team's good too, as we always say.
Exactly. Another division battle, serious playoff implications here, Atlanta at New Orleans. Matt Ryan versus Drew Brees, always a good battle. Wits, fundamentals, all of that. Let's assess the play of each of these quarterbacks through the season.
I think Ryan, Brees is the better quarterback. All right, and I think a lot of people would agree with that heading into the season. So based on these guys and their expectations, I've been more impressed with Ryan and meeting his expectations in with Brees. I think Brees has dropped off a little bit this year. I'd still take him on my team, but the arm strength has not been there quite as consistently. And even some of the decision-making at times, while not bad, but there's been a few iffy calls with Brees. Now, Ryan, you know, things aren't perfect in Atlanta either by any means, and he has more weapons around him than Brees. But I'm really impressed that he's gotten so good at playing on the move and playing with his feet. That's a new dimension to his game, and that could be what eventually tips him over into that whole elite class.
Even though a loss to Pittsburgh last week, Ryan played pretty well without Julio Jones. Those weapons weren't completely there. All he really had to rely on was Roddy White.
Well, he was able to work the ball to Harry Douglas a few times against William Gay's cushion and coverage there, and Atlanta had some really well-designed route combinations, which is always the case with Dirk Cutter. And the Steelers helped him out a little bit by playing some basic zones. Pittsburgh was a bend-but-don't-break defense, which they actually are more than people realize, in fact. But I got the sense watching that Falcons film last week that they would have – I think they would have won that game if they just had a chance to run more plays. I felt like it was one of those – and I know they trailed most of the game, but their offense was a very – it was a good unit, and I felt like it was one of those that they just ran out of time.
Haven't the Saints been kind of a bend-don't-break zone defense as well?
Well, at times I think they bend in the wrong direction and do break, or they a break but break defense. They weren't against Chicago though, and you know they're a break defense because they've changed your personnel this stage of the season. But maybe they got it figured out against Chicago with the personnel. I've been impressed with Pierre Warren at safety for them, that guy that comes in. I think he's off a practice squad in Minnesota, if I recall that correctly. Whatever it was, a guy that hadn't played, essentially, stepped right in and has done a decent job being a starter at free safety for them. But they're looking for answers now, putting Terrence Frederick in at cornerback. Anyone other than Keenan Lewis in that secondary has been iffy at times. And at some point, that's going to catch up to them. I mean, obviously, it's already caught up to them a few times. But at some point, I think you pay a dear price for that, and that we could see that happen this week, in fact.
The Panthers are also right in it in the NFC South. They could be without Cam Newton again this week. We're not really sure, maybe more Derek Anderson. But first, we have to get to Johnny Manziel and what
yes, we
you
do.
Think
it's all Johnny
about
football
Johnny
time.
Football this yep. week. First road start of his career.
It was as bad as the numbers suggested. And it's really, you question what – I question what they have actually seen in practice of him, because he was so far off in the game. I mean, he couldn't function at quarterback. And there were a few times where his attitude was fine. A few times he did the right thing in effort wise and trying to make a play. But more often than not, zero pocket presence, no understanding of how routes relate to coverages at this point, late to pull the trigger. The interceptions he had were horrendous, and not just because they're interceptions, but because he left wide open receivers on the field before throwing the interceptions. And you know how I feel about quarterbacking and how coaches feel as well. There are two things you cannot do in the NFL. One is interceptions, and one is leave receivers open on the field. You especially can't do them. And when we say leave receivers open, that means you don't. They're open, the play design works, but you don't throw them the ball for whatever reason. And Manziel managed to do both of those things, not throw them the ball and then throw the other team the ball on the same play. And there could have been more, too.
Can it just be as simple as the NFL's way too fast for him? It didn't look like he processed anything.
He didn't, and other rookies have come in and not processed as well, but they've had other things they could rely on. It could be. I don't think Manziel is going to be long for this world in the NFL. And he's small, and so when you're small, it's tough to play from the pocket. So he'd never had the foundational skill set developed there. And I know Russell Wilson's small, and he doesn't play from the pocket necessarily. That's an exception to the rule, and Russell Wilson has an NFL-caliber arm. That's the other thing Manziel lacks, is he's very mediocre in arm strength. And so that's why he's different than Drew Brees. And Brees also did come into the league with the foundational pocket presence, probably because Brees didn't have the same kind of mobility that Manziel had, so he had to develop that pocket stuff. Manziel's greatness in college, you could argue that's what will ruin his NFL career, because it's compromised any chance he has at fundamentals. But, you know, maybe it wouldn't have mattered, because if you don't have the arm strength, it's end of story usually.
How much do the Panthers need Cam Newton to be able to go this week? Their playoff chances kind of hang in the balance on this one.
They do. I thought Derek Anderson played really well against Tampa Bay. I thought he could have played better, certainly. But for what you need out of a backup, I thought Carolina ought to be very happy with what they got out of him, because he threw with decisiveness. He threw on time. And I got the sense that if he has more reps, that stuff, he'll be even better there, because there were some cases where it just was rust in terms of, you know, the ball wasn't quite where it needed to be, or it wasn't quite within the design of the play. But overall, and he went up against the zone defense in Tampa Bay, so it wasn't the hardest thing to read. And now he'll be facing a very good man-to-man defense in Cleveland, so it's a different story. But he'll be able to read the field with clarity, and he has a good arm. That's the other thing about Anderson. He has an NFL-caliber arm, no question. So they have a shot with Derek Anderson. The only thing you lose, really, is the mobility factor when you take Newton out. Other than that, passing-wise, there's not a lot of difference. And at the end product, there's not a lot of difference in Newton and Anderson, even though Newton's probably the better pure arm talent.
Pat's Jets this week. Did you see all the Jets fans getting in a bit of an uproar over getting a win over the Titans, now drifting away from the top pick?
They weren't happy about that. They rooting for your team. I remember when I was 6 years old, and I went to the YMCA every day after school, and this is where I learned football. Matt Cox, Judd Benedict, Chris Hahn were my counselors, and they taught me
football. Major shout-outs here.
Oh, I owe them everything, because they taught me my football core values. And I remember one time Chris Hahn, who was a Vikings fan, came in on a Monday and said, yes, I'm so excited, the Vikings got killed. And I thought, wait, that doesn't make any sense. And he said, well, now they're good, they'll get a good pick. And that's how I learned how draft orders work. But I also thought this – I was 6 years old. I thought, this feels dirty to me. He shouldn't be doing this. That's horrible of him.
I can see six-year-old you being outraged.
It was like one of those like interpersonal outrages, because I was learning the world, you know, so I didn't know if I was outraged or not. I just thought, this doesn't feel right. This something's wrong. This man's doing something wrong here.
If you were a Jets fan, though, would you be a little bummed out?
I think I just told you. I don't think the way to and I know that it hurts the draft position. I get that. And that they'll probably have a new coaching staff and a whole new set of players and a lot of positions next year. And so maybe draft position is even more important, because what does this win do for anybody? But I've at the core of all of it, I think the best way to build a foundation as an organization is to win games. I think when you get stuck in this losing and there's an upside to losing, I think that's where you become a loser. And we've seen other teams in the league get mired in not just mediocrity, but well below that, horrendousness. And the Jets don't want to become one of those teams.
The Pats' Darrelle Revis is going to make this a very tough game for the Jets to win. What do you think about him coming back to New York, and who do you think that he shadows this week?
I think he shadows Percy Harvin, because Decker's the guy. Decker can't get off the jam, so you put Brandon Browner on Decker, and I think Decker vanishes. Harvin's the move-around guy. The other thing is Revis has been playing the slot a lot lately, and he did wind up taking Landry last week against Miami like we thought he would. And Landry was the slot guy in Miami. And Revis has been very good there. And so I think you take away Harvin in that regard. Darrell Revis, if J.J. Watt weren't having the season he was having, I think Darrell Revis has worked himself into easy Defensive Player of the Year award. He's, in this case, he's got to be runner-up because there's no taking it from Watt. But Revis has been absolutely – he's the old Darrell Revis, absolutely sensational.
The Pats have to lock him up, right?
If Revis is willing to take a be locked up. You know, Sean Gilbert is his uncle and closest advisor, and Sean Gilbert understands the money value, and I think he has instructed Revis over the years or taught him to bet on yourself, Darrell, because you're at the superstar level, you actually will – you could lose money by signing a long-term deal theoretically. And so Revis bets on himself, and he might just want another one-year contract, and he's making $1 million a game over the last few years.
By the way, last week against the Pats, Jarvis Landry had 8 catches for 99 yards.
I have no idea how that happened. Oh, I do have an idea. Because and I turned off the film at about halfway through the fourth. I did watch the first half of the fourth quarter when they moved Revis over to Mike Wallace. And they did that because they were worried. I think Mike Wallace, by the way, here's how you know Bill Belichick thinks highly of Mike Wallace. He put Butler on Mike Wallace. I think he's an undrafted rookie or some you know, the number 5 cornerback who occasionally plays. He put Butler on Wallace. Last year he didn't even have Aqib Talib on Wallace. So Belichick's not worried about Mike Wallace. But in the fourth quarter when they're up by 25, he did worry about him because he knew that if there's one guy that could beat us deep, and Wallace did beat him deep once on an amazing catch, they didn't want to have that happen again, so he put Revis on him. And my guess is that's where Landry's catches started coming from, because I only saw Landry catch, I think, 1 or 2 balls when Revis was on him.
Speaking of the Dolphins this week hosting the Vikings, Joe Philbin has been thrust a bit into the hot seat so far this season. Is this fair for Joe Philbin, or is this unfair?
It's fair, I guess, to be in the hot seat. I mean, that's part of the job. That's what happens. Do I think that's
Is it a fair assessment of his coaching?
Yeah, no, I don't think should Stephen Ross fire Joe Philbin? I say no, I don't think so. I think Miami's been fine, nothing better than fine, certainly. And maybe next year is Philbin's prove-it year. I'm not a big fan, you know, overhauling a coaching staff, that's a big process. That takes some time to come back from that, because then you got to work in a whole new system. And do you really want to put Ryan Tannehill in a new scheme a third year in a row, which is what you would be doing if you fired that coaching staff? I don't think you want to do that, because Tannehill's development has been steady, maybe slow in some regards, but steady overall. And I think he's still worth building around. So I do it to keep continuity there.
More read option.
Oh, there it is.
That's
you had this little look
gotta,
on your face, and I didn't know what was coming.
Got to get the read option back.
He had. We got him once, New England once on read option it was.
With the strength of that Miami defense and the talent
you know
of
what?
Tannehill, it seems like Philbin should have been able to do better than 7-7 this season.
Maybe.
I thought this was the prove-it year.
I got to interrupt you a little bit there, because I know I'm the one that said Miami's defense the best in the league. Since I said that, they've face-planted. They were 2 or 3 in rankings, and I thought, as I said, number 1 in my mind before all that, but they've been just awful their last 3 games. That's not on Joe Philbin, though. He doesn't run the defense, and that's on Coyle. Well, and I'm not blaming Coyle, Kevin Coyle, as their coordinator for it, but Miami does this. That's the other thing. And I think they've done this even before Philbin, if I recall. It just feels like too often, and maybe this might be the damning argument against Philbin, if I'm to play devil's advocate. Hasn't Miami had a lot of late-season failure in his tenure?
They lost 3 of the last 5 in 2012, and then last season finished out the season with 2 losses, Bills and Jets. But over the last 4 games, it's been the run defense for Miami that's just crumbled. Against the Broncos, allowed 201 on the ground, 277 to the Jets, 200 in the first half. It's just been a mess. So the consistency has not been there for Miami.
We worried about that earlier in the year, too, because we've seen this happen before, and I don't know the reason for it. And it's happened even when they had other players in there. I remember, like, the Paul Soliai era, and he was a good nose shade for them. But that run defense has worn down late in games before, and especially late in the season before, if I recall. And, you know, on offense, offensive tackle issues were the case last year, and they've had those again this year. So do you really blame the coach for that? That their offensive linemen keep getting hurt.
That Bills team that caught them there at the end of the season last year is on the road against the Raiders this week. Much more consistent defense for the Bills in man coverage and in run defense.
And some people didn't like when I tweeted this week that the secondary is the driving force behind a lot of Buffalo's success. It's, oh, no, it's the front four, because that's what the local news people tell you. The front four has been excellent. It might be the best in the league, in fact. But I'm telling you, watch the 22 film, and it's the defensive backs are creating coverage sacks, and they're also limiting what teams can do. They're just dominating teams through the passing game. They're limiting passing offenses. It's much easier to rush the passer when there's coverage behind you on the back end, because you can do a lot with your pressure concepts. You're more inclined to do stunts and twists and stuff that might take a little bit longer to unfold typically, because you trust your guys to line up and hold their coverage. The Bills have a great secondary. The linebackers have been better, but it's the secondary that's carrying that defense most.
And a lot of that has to do with the success of Stephon Gilmore there on the side.
I love him. He's a Seahawks type of cornerback.
What does that mean? Physical?
Yeah, physical, lanky.
He's likes to hold.
He gets away with it too. Yeah. Getting away with it as a defensive back, that's an attribute. That's like right up there with speed, agility, tackling ability, ability to get away with physicality.
And the Bills, 8-6, get their ninth win. If they can finish this out with a 10-win Bills team, that'd be kind of cool to see.
You'd like that. Aren't you kind of not a Bills fan, but one of the Bills believer?
Yeah, I was high on the
Bills.
I was high on the Bills preseason. Losing Kiko Alonso didn't help, but they're a fun team to watch, and that defense can be really exciting. Another exciting defense, St. Louis Rams, who are hosting the New York Giants, and it looks like Tom Coughlin is on a bit of a hot seat of his own. Even after winning two Super Bowls, it doesn't seem too clear what his future is there in New York.
He's been on, if you're a coach in New York, your seat is hot the day you take over. And so, I don't understand it. I'd be surprised if they fire him, but, whatever. I thought Jeff Fisher could have been on the hot seat before this defensive surge by his team, and it's been quite impressive what that defense has done lately.
For as low scoring as that Cardinals-Rams game was, 12-6, it was a lot of fun to watch. Those defenses were mean.
They are. They're fast, and I'm so impressed with St. Louis's. You know who I think the best – that's an exaggeration. Their best player is Robert Quinn. But if I were to start a guy with one – or start a team with one guy other than Robert Quinn on that defense, and maybe other than Aaron Donald.
Okay, you know who McDonald?
That's exactly who I'd start with.
I know you. I can read you like a book, Andy.
Well, when I eliminate two of the guys, that helps as well. And we know it's not going to be Janoris Jenkins.
Probably not.
And Jolon Dunbar, so now there's two more eliminated. But McDonald's outstanding. Lanky, he's getting smarter. That whole defensive secondary is getting smarter. Remember early in the year we were concerned about how the young secondary would handle Greg Williams' high-volume playbook, and they didn't handle it well at first. They were overwhelmed at times, but as the season's progressed, they've gotten continuously better, and they've clearly handled it well, and now we're seeing Greg Williams do. They are the most fun team to watch on film, and that's the most difficult defense, I think, right now to game plan against because of A, the talent they have in the front four, and B, the stuff they can do with their back seven schematically. And we've seen some great things. E.J. Gaines played middle linebacker in some Tampa 2 coverages. That's brilliant. That replaces a linebacker with a cornerback and the most important part of the field in coverage. They've had other wrinkles like that as well, and I can't wait to see what they have in store for the Giants.
What kind of a defensive attack do you have to go up against Coughlin with and Ben McAdoo against all these timing routes if you're the Rams?
Zone blitzes would be a good one. I'd put some athletes back in the quick passing lanes.
Because Eli Manning can really manipulate a linebacking core too, but this is a good one. Alec Ogletree and James Laurinaitis, who we had on a podcast before.
Laurinaitis is as smart as any linebacker in the league, and he's played faster each year in his career, which tells you he gets smarter each year. Ogletree is always a fast player, and he has a chance to be a real star, and I think he's going to connect on that because he's shown a heightened awareness as well, and he's been a very good blitzer for them, which is to be expected. And Laurinaitis has actually blitzed even more than Ogletree lately, and he's a good blitzer.
Philadelphia at Washington this week. The Eagles still control their own destiny, and it seems like Nick Foles is on his way back into the lineup. Do you think he is the quarterback moving forward?
I don't know. I struggle with that one. I thought they would be better with Sanchez, and I think in some regards they have been, although Sanchez has kind of drifted back towards his norm, and that is with questionable arm talent. He's not a big-time – in fact, he's not a true anticipation passer, so that's a bad mix to have. Like, Tom Brady's not an anticipation passer either. He can anticipate. He's just not that kind of guy, not that kind of player. But he's a great arm talent. I mean, he can throw a fastball. when you can't anticipate, Sanchez, he doesn't have a great fastball. You get into some problems, but that's a well-designed offense, as we know. I don't know who you go with here. I still think Sanchez is the better fit because he's a quicker twitcher of an athlete than Foles is. But, you know, Sanchez is not an athlete himself. He's not a big-time running QB, certainly.
He does have pretty good mobility, though, in the pocket that Nick Foles seems uncomfortable a lot when he has to move around.
I would agree with that, but I wouldn't quite label Sanchez as comfortable. I think the later in the down it gets, the worse he gets, and that's the sign of bad quarterbacking more than good quarterbacking.
For the quarterback on the other side, RG3 didn't look too bad last week against New York.
Yeah, he did compared to other games that he's put on film this year. I mean, there were still some of the limitations with him, and I'm sure Jay Gruden wasn't thrilled with the tape, at least not compared to what the stat book showed or what you might assume. But Griffin did have some flash plays. There were some good things he did, and he seemed to have a more of a willingness to pull the trigger within the timing of the offense. But there were also plenty of snaps where he did not have that still.
Seeing his legs moving again, though, and seeing him running around a bit feels good because we always talk about that's what made him special in the first place.
And I know it got called back, but that touchdown at the end of the half, I was encouraged by the physical output of that. That it looked like he had some wheels again. You're right. And so if he can get that back, although you could argue that that could be a hindrance, the same thing with Manziel, where his running was, you know, a hindrance to his development, or it's going to prove to be. That could be the case with Griffin, too. Someone made a great point, someone I really respect, this I heard this week. They said the more comfortable Griffin gets, the more likely he is to run. And that's a very bad sign for a quarterback. You cannot build around that. It should be the other way around.
The 49ers this week hosting the San Diego Chargers. Niners are out of the playoffs. Chargers may be joining them as well. We'll start with a question that a lot of people are asking about these two quarterbacks is what is the future moving forward? It seems crazy to even think that Philip Rivers' future could be in question in San Diego.
And I don't think it is. I think the people who are asking that are either A, foolish, or B, they are asking from the standpoint of, well, has this team reached a ceiling with Rivers? I mean, what is he? He's got to be 32 years old. Yeah. You know that for sure? You know the age?
I believe I do.
Okay. Well, you're very good with ages, I know.
33.
Okay, I've got the depth chart right here. Let's just
Way to put me on stand.
He's 33, yeah. He just turned 33 9 days ago. Okay.
Me and my ages,
anyway,
man. Ask me how old Larry Fitzgerald is.
That's not old for a quarterback. 33 is not old for a quarterback.
Quarterback prime.
It is anymore, and his style of play, I think it is. So you're not going to go out and find a better QB than Phillip Rivers. He's not the problem. I think this is a good Chargers team. They just it's a very good AFC this year, and San Diego's come up a little bit short. They had injuries at offensive line and running back, and last year it was the other way around, and they were able to win with running game down the stretch. They haven't had that kind of dimension this season. San Francisco's a different story. I don't think they're going to cut bait with Kaepernick. I would if I were them, but I don't think they will.
If Jim Harbaugh leaves, you don't think they'll just wipe away the Kaepernick era altogether?
No.
Seems like that would be the way to go. Just start clean.
No, because Trent Baalke drafted Kaepernick, and Harbaugh leaves, but the team's not getting overhauled.
Wasn't the rumor that Jim Harbaugh was, like, jumping on desks and pounding walls to get Kaepernick? It was his pick.
Okay, maybe it was
that's
his.
That's what I've heard.
Okay, maybe it was his pick. Have you heard anything about how Kaepernick or how Baalke feels about Kaepernick?
From what I have heard, the whole front office is a mess, and that Jim Harbaugh's relationship with ownership and the heads of the team is not good at all.
No. I want to know if you've heard anything, and I know you're afraid to say it. I want to know if you've heard anything about
Kaepernick's future?
With Baalke.
Kaepernick and Baalke are good.
You know Niners stuff. You do know Niners stuff. I know that.
Yeah, I know some Niners people. I don't know that situation is bad. I know that I know some more about the Jim Harbaugh situation. I don't know.
And Harbaugh sounds like he's a tough guy to deal with, and that's not going to work out. I don't think you overhaul the Kaepernick side of things, though. I would. I don't think they will.
That's interesting.
Why?
Well, but it seems like the structuring of his contract was for the Niners' benefit, that they could move on it.
I don't know if they did that because they wanted to. I think they did because why the hell wouldn't you take that if you could as a team? Why not? Look at Jay Cutler's situation.
He does the one-word answer thing in the press conference.
Irrelevant.
It doesn't look like he gives a damn, Andy. That is relevant.
No, he doesn't give a damn about the media stuff, and that's irrelevant. He gives a damn about playing quarterback. he's just not understanding how to do it very well right now.
So would you rather have a Kaepernick who is supposed to be your team's leader saying nothing to the media or a quarterback that spews out nonsense coach speak?
I would rather have a quarterback that goes out and plays well. I mean, I don't care how my quarterback treats the media. I mean, why would I care about that?
Because perception is reality.
No, it's not. People already have their judgments about Kaepernick to begin with. I mean, who cares about
I think the locker room cares. I think that
the
has
locker
some...
room cares about how Colin Kaepernick treats the media. No way. Now maybe Jed York cares, but not enough to change the quarterback. Alex Smith was very nice to the media. Great, everyone loves him. How did that work out for him?
If we're going to say that a coach has to remove a poor playing quarterback from the field to not lose the locker room, I think the locker room could equally be lost from a quarterback looking like he's not the leader of the team. So if he doesn't look like he's buying in, why the hell would the rest of the locker room? That's my point.
I think the evidence you're showing that he's not buying in is just false evidence. I don't think anybody on the team cares in that locker room about how Kaepernick treats the media. Now, the issues they might care about is obviously how he treats his teammates, how he's preparing. I don't know how he is in that regard. He might be great. He might be awful. I have no idea. But they also care about how he performs, and the performance has not been there. So we could talk about that. But what he does with the media, that's totally irrelevant.
So if Kaepernick isn't getting cut from the Niners, then...
And he's not going to get cut.
Okay, yeah. You say, so is he the building piece then?
Like, can you build around him?
Yeah, is he the guy you plan the rest of your team about, or it's specifically your offense?
No, he's not to me. I don't know if it will be to them.
So then what are we talking
about? I'm arguing both sides here because I'm saying personally I would get rid of Kaepernick, but not for the reasons you're talking about.
Okay.
I don't care about that. We got into a tangent. That's what it was, the media tangent. Because I think Kaepernick's fundamentally flawed, and some of that stuff, I don't know if it's correctable. He should be reading the field, period, right now. Not just better, but period. And there's times where he doesn't read the field. He doesn't understand quarterbacking basics. His talent is off the charts, but he's also an inconsistent passer, which tells you, and it's because his mechanics can be inconsistent. He's not good throwing on the move, which is a major problem because he's the guy who moves. And so I would get rid of Kaepernick for those reasons. I think San Francisco feels that way, but it's almost back to the argument I made about Rivers in this game. And okay, but get rid of Kaepernick, you're going to go out and find a more talented player. Where are you going to find that? And I don't think you would just find that. I think he's worth developing still one more year from that standpoint. And if I'm the Niners and I factor in the business side of things, I would give it certainly one more year. But I'm not, as a guy that's just an analyst here that doesn't have any skin in game, get to say whatever I want, I'm not confident that he will ever succeed given one more year or five more years.
The Niners will stick with Kaepernick. We hope you stick with us next week. This is all for the Monday Morning Quarterback podcast, week 16. You can follow Andy on Twitter at Andy_Benoit. Remember to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You'll get it in your inbox every Thursday morning. Thanks.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.